This is the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
All right, I'm going to zap her again. Charge up the paddles. Come on, let's go.
Sorry, Doctor.
Hold the compressions.
Clear.
Straight line.
Good evening and welcome to Rock and Roll Autopsy. We are the Forensic Files on your radio dial. My name is Scott, and if we got a great show for you tonight, no, we don't. Damn it. That goddamn intern. The phone is ringing. It's the request line. All right, let's pick it up. WRNRA, east of the Rockies. Hey, breather, what's going on, man? You went home for a visit, only to be totally bummed out by the sprawling retail blight, an ocean of empty parking lots, and the abandoned, vacant infrastructure of what was once a thriving economic community. Yeah, I hear you, man. Depending on your perspective, the death of the brick and mortar could be a negative byproduct of the rise of technology. What do you mean the real negative byproduct of technology is the rise of shitty rock and roll podcasts? Listen, you called the request line. Is there a song you'd like us to perform an autopsy on? My City Was Gone by the Pretenders? You got it. All right, buckle up, gang. The subject of our rock and roll autopsy tonight will be My City Was Gone by New Wave England via Akron Rockers, The Pretenders. It's episode 2 of our multi-episode deep dive into Rust Belt rock and roll. So get your pierogi and Parma pink flamingos ready. We're going to find out if Cleveland killed rock and roll.
On the shores of beautiful Lake Erie.
You don't live in Cleveland.
Cleveland.
Bumble.
Bumble. Hello, Cleveland. Hello, Cleveland.
Cleveland.
Cleveland rocks. Rocks.
Breaking news.
What is this garbage you're watching?
I want to watch the news.
This is the news.
All right, gang, we've got our intrepid rock and roll beat reporter on the line and Mark from Songs That Don't Suck, Rico Canu, everybody.
No, Canoes.
Hey, thanks, Scott. Welcome back, Mark.
It's good to be back.
And also, let's just get the particulars out of the way. Thanks to all of you out there. You guys all fucking rock for taking the time to listen to us babble on. So thanks for doing that. If you like what you hear, go grab somebody and make them listen to us. I think they won't regret it. So I want to take you guys back to the early 1900s, Scott. Why are we doing that? Way back in the early 1900s, there was this dude, right? This dude named John Cyberling. Do you think anybody outside of Northeast Ohio knows who that dude is?
No!
Not a chance in hell, right? John Cyberling was a former farm equipment manufacturer. He was one of the first ones to build the Reaper, not the dude that wears a robe, but the machine that harvests crops, right? And he was struggling because that went out of business. So what did he do? He found a warehouse in Akron. He borrowed $3,500 and started Goodyear Tire And the rest is history, right? So we have Akron. I'll get to why this is important for rock and roll.
I want to rock.
So what happened, guys and girls out there, is Akron, Ohio, became a really important spot because it was 2 hours south of Detroit, which is where the auto industry was. So Akron was like the tire making center of the universe at the perfect time when the auto industry was taking off and getting huge like a nuclear explosion. And so what do? You include Quaker Oats in there. That's right, guys and girls. The Quaker Oats headquarters with its oat mills and everything was right in downtown Akron, right by Goodyear. And so what do when we have all this booming industry in Akron? We've got the CyberLinks building a house that's bigger than Summit County that is still a museum. It's really pretty cool, actually. It's called Stan Hewitt. If anybody's in Akron, you should check it out. But what do we do when you have a booming rubber industry where you're the center of the tire making world? You also have the center of the oatmeal world. You put in a Union Depot station, right? This is where it gets really important. So the Union Depot station gets put into Akron for obvious reasons. And there's ancillary benefit for that, guys. What's the ancillary benefit? Well, Akron just happens to be in the middle, right around the halfway point between New York and Chicago. And in the 20s and 30s, when all this was going down, it just happened to be, like I said, a really cool halfway spot for the jazz artists that were traveling between New York and Chicago. They would stop in Akron because it was a good place to stop because it was the halfway point. So consequently, Akron became a really hot spot for jazz, especially black jazz like Count Basie, Ella Fitzgerald, Cab Calloway, Louis Armstrong. All of those big, huge 20s and 30s black jazz artists all stopped in Cleveland often. Did you guys know that? Scott, you're in the South Howard district. That's right kind of where you live, right?
Yes, sir. In my neck of the woods, for sure.
In your neck of the woods. When's the last time you were over there? I mean, you could probably walk there in about 20 minutes, right?
Yeah, but I try not to leave my home.
What's it look like now?
I think last time I went through the area, I was propositioned.
Oh, well, that's not a bad thing, is it? I mean, who doesn't want to be propositioned? Anyway, the point of this, we're talking like... So in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, actually, what happened in the 50s, guys? That's when Alan Freed and Leo Mintz talked about, hey, these really cool jazz and blues and all these black artists that are really starting to take off. And part of that was because of what was happening in Akron. Akron was very culturally alive in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, and it was really going in a great direction, but alas... The Urban Renewal Project movement of the late 60s and 70s. That's what killed it, dude. The Urban Renewal Project happened. They put the Inner Belt right through the heart of downtown Akron, and that killed everything. Like 700 families were displaced. Most of them were black families. Like 100 mom and pop business owners had to relocate, and a lot of them didn't survive that, and a lot of them were black owned businesses. That whole cool ass jazz scene in South Howard just disappeared because the idea behind the urban renewal was great, but it was, and I don't know how it got executed in other parts of the country, but they fucking blew the bunny in Akron, man. Like, it took Scott, how long did it take Akron to come back from that? Like, really?
I think the birth of LeBron James.
I was going to say, has it actually come back yet?
Yeah. No. I think to a certain degree, it kind of has a little bit. But when you hear Scott in previous episodes talk about how, like, you know, Mother's Ball and Hine and all them talk about how Akron was a shithole and how they don't have anything nice to say about it, it's because of the Urban Renewal Project was so poorly executed around here that it killed an entire city, and a really sweet very nicely growing, cool-ass culture that was developing in Akron all went away because of how crappy that urban renewal was executed around. It really is pretty sad, but that is why, you know, without the jazz movement in Akron, you know, the Alan Freed, Leo Mintz conversation may never have taken place.
It's very true.
So we have to include the importance of Akron and its jazz scene as it relates to Alan Freed inventing the term rock and roll, because it was just right down the road. So
yeah. And anyone who thinks like those artists are rolling through Akron and they're not going to travel the 20 miles north to Cleveland to play a show, you know, Akron might have been the centralized hub for that area, for Howard Street and that jazz scene. But you know, that kind of permeated throughout the whole region.
There was a pipeline between Akron and Cleveland. And again, that's how guys like Leo Mintz even knew what was going on. That's why he had the records in his stores, because of what was going on in Akron. And those people were coming up to Cleveland because it's close. I mean, you could take a cab, or you could take a train or whatever from Akron to Cleveland in like a half an hour, 45 minutes. And you do a gig up in Cleveland, come back, do a gig in Akron, and then take your train to Chicago or New York or wherever you're going. So the two are very interconnected.
But did they eat Swenson's?
You ain't fat. You ain't fat. You ain't fat. You ain't nothing.
I'm not fat. I'm big boned.
Let me ask you something. You brought up a good one. If gun to your head, Scott, you ready for this? And Mark, I need your opinion, Mark. Mark, more importantly, Mark, actually, because I already know where Scott's going to go with this. Gun to your head, Swenson's or Skyway?
Swenson's.
Really?
Fuck yeah.
You didn't even think about that.
I don't have to. I've eaten Skyway, and I've eaten Swenson's, and one of them I would eat again, and it isn't Skyway.
Do you know when Jimmy Buffett used to come in town, he used to specifically request Skyway over Swenson's?
That's because everybody has faults. Look, I've had dinner with that man accidentally. I'll have to tell that story sometime. But I mean, I know he eats good stuff, but that was the one error he made in his culinary decisions.
Did you guys talk about that when you had dinner with him?
No, we didn't. I was in way too much shock to talk to him. I just sat across from him eating my steak.
Where were you?
I was at Buckeye Lake, concert down there in 1995. I was part of the management crew for setting the whole thing up, and they gave us catering tickets, and I went backstage thinking I was getting like a burger or a hot dog or something, and like have my plate, and they drop a giant steak and a baked potato on it. I'm like, wow, Jimmy feeds his people well. I sit down at the table, and then Jimmy walks in with his bodyguard, who's like 6'9", giant black dude, like scary as hell. And they sit down across from me, and I literally peed my pants. I was in shock.
Damn.
I was going to say, you were just a baby in 1995.
I was in college.
Yeah.
Wow.
That is
crazy.
Yeah,
man. Like when I worked for Blossom Music Center, I was a production assistant during the concerts. And yeah, man, like when you are a production assistant or when you're doing stuff backstage, you eat what the band eats. And if they cater some really good shit, then you get to eat really good shit. That's one of the benefits of doing that. So yeah, I had some experiences with that myself, actually.
To recap, Jimmy's wrong. R.I.P. That's probably why he died.
Can you at least throw him a bone on the onion rings? Like, you gotta say Skyway's onion rings are pretty good, right?
They're not bad.
Man, you're difficult. Holy crap.
I just know what I like.
Do you go for, like, okay, Swenson's, like, you go Galley Boy or just straight cheeseburger?
Double cheeseburger.
Double cheeseburger, okay. You go in California or milkshake?
Actually, yeah, the California is generally the direction I go.
Yeah, that's a good choice, man. Scott, what's a California for those people out there that don't know what that is?
I have no idea.
I think it's ginger ale and grape juice, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, ginger ale and grape juice mixed together. It's phenomenal.
Is that a Swenson's thing?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Don't they have a Florida too, where they have ginger ale and orange pop or something like that?
It's been a minute. They might. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, enough of this silly food talk. Listen, don't forget, Akron figures very prominent in rock and roll history because of the sweet ass jazz scene that I just laid out. And don't take my word for it. Feel free to go online and look it up for yourself, and you will see that I am absolutely correct in that Akron was a pretty cool spot and no longer is, but it's trying to be cool again. But it's they tried, and they were really had a good thing going there. But we'll get into more of that. So why don't we take a quick break if you guys are okay with that? Yeah. And when we come back, we're gonna talk about Chrissie Hynde and the Pretenders. So stick around.
Looking for a good rock and roll book? Do you watch a ton of rock and roll documentaries like I do? Well, that's why I started the Rock Talk Studio podcast, to be the place to go for previews, reviews, and recommendations of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies. Every first Tuesday of the month, the Rock Talk Studio gets you caught up on all the latest and points out where to go for the good stuff. Give me 20 minutes and I'll get you caught up on the world of rock and roll books, docs, and movies from every possible angle and leave you with a no-doubt decision on where to spend your time and money. Fan or just casual fan, or maybe you're on the fence and just looking for something new to check out, either way, I got you covered. Recently on the show, I've talked about books and documentaries from everyone and everything from David Bowie, Randy Rhoads, and the Allman Brothers, to the Abbey Road Studios, Cheap Trick, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Little Richard, and more. Join me, Big Rick, every Tuesday of the month as I host a Rock Talk Studio podcast, the ultimate review of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies.
Our Mind on Music is a podcast that covers all things music. We cover all genres and we welcome all perspectives, from musicians, producers, and content creators to music enthusiasts. We have discussions, interviews, opinions, and much, much more. We hope you'll join us every week, Our Mind on Music, on YouTube and all streaming platforms.
What's up, music nerds? Are you tired of wading through a sea of mediocre music, desperately seeking to find a glimmer of greatness? You're in luck. My name is Mark, and I am the host of the podcast, Songs That Don't Suck. Each week, I scour the depths of new music playlists to unearth hidden gems that defy the trends and deliver pure sonic bliss. No matter the genre, if it doesn't suck, it's on my radar. So find us on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe today. And as always, keep searching for and listening to Songs That Don't Suck.
We are gathered here to remember rock and roll. Rock was born the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues. In the year of our Lord, 1955. On this day, the birth of rock and roll, gifted unto the world a gyrating pelvis, a throbbing beat, and a pulsating rhythm. A sound so infectious and rollicking that it would endow previously scrupulous young minds with identity, individualism, and purpose, thus setting forth a multi-generational pursuit of all that is loud, debaucherous, and unholy. But, sadly, like all earthly endeavors, rock too must perish. Oh, we mourn the loss of rock and roll, with its ridiculously old standard bearers still on tour and charging ungodly amounts of Mad Jack to witness their long past the sell-by date asses on stage, and with its chauvinism, misogyny, and whiteness no longer aligning with modern sensibilities, and with its aging, fist-shaking fan base kicking every would-be rocker off their proverbial lawn, rock has indeed passed into the celestial void. May rock rest in peace in eternal cacophonous slumber. Amen.
Thank you for that, Scott.
You are listening to the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
The Autopsy Report.
Hey, welcome back, guys, girls, children of all ages. Welcome back. We're going to be talking My City Was Gone by the Pretenders. Give me one second here. Chrissy Hynde and the gang. Chrissy Hynde wrote this. It's off of the album. Gosh, hold on a second. My sheet is gone here.
Learning to Crawl.
That's it. Learning to Crawl. I had a brain fart there for a sec. 1982, I believe. But the real question is not where my notes are, but the real question is did this song kill rock and roll? And we're about to find out.
Thank you, Rico. We've got Mark from Songs That Don't Suck. He's still with us. Mark, how are you, sir?
I'm fantastic, man. I love doing this with y'all. I love kind of examining Northeast Ohio's either contribution or defending of life. it's fantastic. I'm so glad you guys have asked me to join you for these.
We love having you. It's Rock and Roll Autopsy. Rico, thank you for your autopsy report. The song is My City Is Gone. And it is the Pretenders. It's Chrissy Hynde. I would see Chrissy Hynde's mug on the wall of my high school every single morning when I would walk in. They had this wall of fame. I was just there this past Friday for a show, and the wall of fame has expanded. It now includes the Black Keys and some other people. I don't know who they are. I don't know, like American Idol contestants or something. I don't know. I'm not in it. I digress.
Have Chrissy they not Hynde, heard the podcast?
It's not really a wall of fame if you're not on there then, right?
I'm not on there. No, they have not. They're not recognizing Rock and Roll Autopsy yet.
Give them time.
Give them time. Anywho, so we got to figure out if this thing killed rock and roll. And dear listener, you might be asking yourself, well, how does one go about doing that? Well, the truth is that you lean into science. And we have taken it upon ourselves over 3,000 episodes now. We have developed this proprietary science. Rico, you keep vanishing periodically. There you go. You're back again. We've developed proprietary science that consists of five categories. They are gratuitous boomerism, excessive misogyny, wanton whiteness, malignant machismo, and culture vulturism. The artist is it the Pretenders or Pretenders? These bands with the I never get it.
It is the Pretenders.
Thank you. It's the Pretenders, the album Learning to Crawl, the track My City Was Gone, and the category gratuitous boomerism. We'll just go round robin here. I'll start with you, Mark, since you are our esteemed guest. And if you're tired of listening to this, feel free to turn it off and turn on Songs That Don't Suck right now. Just bail on it. It's okay. We're taking an hour of your time. Mark will take 15 minutes, so he's way more efficient. Mark, the category is gratuitous boomerism. The song, My City Was Gone. Sir, what say you?
So, you know, obviously she was born. Do we have, what year was she born?
I have it. Hold tight.
51, hold, I believe.
51? Okay.
Yes, sir. 51.
So she's obviously a boomer, but I'm actually going to push that to the side because I was thinking about this and the whole idea around this song, My City Was Gone, was that she went away. Things changed and she came back. And I feel like it's such a boomer mentality that the minute like somebody moves their cheese, they get all bent out of shape and they decide to write a hit song about it. Boomers are super sentimental in that regards because a lot of them are hoarders. I've decided like my parents held on to stuff. Like I recently moved them out of their house and into a senior living community, and the random crap that they had held on to for years and years. My wife's parents, same thing. When we were moving their couch, we found the receipt of the purchase, and it was like purchased in the 70s. And I'm like, why do you still have this receipt? There's this sentimental attachment to stuff, and cities are included in that. So the minute your neighborhood changes or gets run down or, you know, razzed and redeveloped, they're going to write a song about it. So based on just this boomer reaction to change, I'm going to drop a full point on the Pretenders for this one.
Science, right?
Science.
All right, Rico, what say you, sir?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at face value, it could appear as if she's being Uncle Stan here.
Well, when I was a kid, everything was cool. But then when I go away for a little while and I come back and the city's gone to shit. It's not like it used to be.
At face value, you could say that she's being like that. However, there's nothing generation specific, or there's nothing about this song, in my opinion, that can't transcend generations. We all reminisce. We all think about the past and the good things about the past. That's been going on since the beginning of time. That's why we talk about history, because we remember good things about history and why we remember bad things about history. And that's why in 150 years, people will reminisce about this podcast and how great it is. And so there's nothing wrong about remembering what was good about your childhood and what was good about things that happened in the past. For me personally, it's going to be zero.
Not even the obligatory 0.5 for her age.
Sorry, man. Science.
Science. Scott, what do you say?
Thank you, Mark. I'm going to give it a one, and I'll tell you why. For one thing, I feel I get the conversation here, Mark. I thought that was a great observation, especially the hoarding angle, which I'd never thought of, but I had family members going through my brain while you were saying that.
I know, right?
And Rico, I appreciate your perspective as always. It makes sense, but I'm going to score it 0.5 because she's a boomer. It's a boomer band. And also, the song kind of became the de facto theme song to the Rush Limbaugh show. If you remember, he would bump in and out of every single break with this song. And so for that alone, it's become almost like a boomer soundtrack. Mark, you're pointing at me. You've got something to say.
The funny thing about it was she was living in the UK. She didn't even know who Rush Limbaugh was. She had no idea that song was being used.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned, I'm going to score that a one and then we'll move on, but you mentioned her leaving and then coming back. One of the best books, highly recommend. This book is by a gentleman named Nick Kent, who wrote for New Music Express for years. He wrote a book called Apathy for the Devil, and he was in a relationship with Chrissy Hynde back in the 70s. And she went over and lived in England, and she was running with Nick Kent and Lemmy. And she became a star later on. So she had completely kind of removed herself from Northeast Ohio. So I didn't realize she had gone back and was unaware that Rush Limbaugh had adopted this song in the 90s.
So should she pay the price because she didn't know somebody was copping her song?
How could you? I mean, I don't know how she could not know. I mean, that was one of the biggest like talk radio shows in the country back then. So I don't know how
it really was. It really was. Know that.
Yeah. If I recall this article I was reading, some fans had actually reached out to her and gotten word to her and told her that they should, like, she should force him to stop using it. And she didn't, because she's like, I don't like being told what to do. So she's.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's kind of boomerific as well. All right, I'm going to go ahead and score that a one. Let's move on to category two, excessive misogyny. Mark, it's your turn at the plate here. I've got the lyrics available if you'd like me to read them.
Yeah, let's hit some spoken word. I love it.
I went back to Ohio, but my city was gone. There was no train station. There was no downtown. South Howard had disappeared. All my favorite places, my city had been pulled down, reduced to parking spaces. A.O., way to go, Ohio. Can I read one more verse, Mark?
Absolutely.
Well, I went back to Ohio, but my family was gone. I stood on the back porch. There was nobody home. I was stunned and amazed. My childhood memories slowly swirled past like the wind through the trees. A.O., way to go, Ohio. Excessive misogyny, Mark. What say you?
I mean, there's nothing here from a misogynistic standpoint. I will say, other than the AO Ohio part, she really writes some beautiful lyrics. But that last part of it just kind of loses it for me. But yeah, I mean, obviously there's nothing misogynistic lyrically. Nothing in the way that it's delivered that makes you think that it's misogynistic. So yeah, it's a big old goose egg for me.
Rico, what say you?
Can you do all of our dear listener a favor and read the last line of that song?
Okay, can I just nail out the last verse in? Would that be cool? Thank you.
Do it.
I went back to Ohio, but my pretty countryside had been paved down the middle by a government that had no pride. The farms of Ohio had been replaced by shopping malls, and Muzak filled the air from Seneca to Cuyahoga Falls. Said A.O., oh, way to go, Ohio.
So yeah, all that stuff that I talked about in the first segment is all in this song. And you know how, Scott, if anybody that knows this song, do you know how I know that she's a local? You know how I know she's a local?
I know.
Mark, how do I know she's a local?
It's in the way that she pronounces Cuyahoga.
You got it, baby. You got it. That is exactly it. Because most, if not all of us here in Northeast Ohio, Scott actually pronounced Cuyahoga the way everybody else in America would pronounce Cuyahoga. But the way Chrissy Hind pronounces Cuyahoga is actually the way most of us here say it. That whole middle part, we just leave off. And we all say Cuyahoga, Cuyahoga Falls, Cuyahoga River. That's how we all know she's a local, because nobody outside of Northeast Ohio says it that way. That's kind of like that city in Massachusetts that looks like the sauce that you marinate your steaks in. They call it Worcester, Massachusetts, but it's actually Worcester, right?
Watch
how
sister.
You know there's a local. Huh? Yeah, right. Or if any of you have ever been to New York and you're on the subway and one of the stops is that city in Texas that begins with an H. Right? What's that city in Texas? Houston, right? But not if you're a local in New York. It's Houston, actually.
Yeah.
So here in Ohio, it's Cuyahoga. That's how she's a local. But yeah, to get back to the point, there's no fucking way there's misogyny in this song. It's just her discussing how her city has gone to hell because of some really bad governmental decisions. So obviously, it's going to get a zero for me.
And just, Scott, before you score this, every time I hear her sing it, Cuyahoga, I think of Alice Cooper in Wayne's World going, Milwaukee. it's Algonquin for the good lands.
Can one of you guys explain to me why she throws Seneca in there? Because I still can't figure that out.
Probably just poetic license, I would guess.
Yeah, syllables.
The only Seneca I know is the county that Sandusky is in, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's weird.
All right. Thank you, Rico. Listen, here's my main beef. Obviously, it's a zero for excessive misogyny, but a digression. I don't know. Rico just talked at length in the news section about how developed and swinging Akron was in like the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and how it sounds like this like thriving metropolis, right? People coming from all over the country for work. We've got hip music and business, a thriving metropolis, right? But she's describing a pretty countryside and farms. I mean, this is the Akron I grew up in. So, I mean, and she's growing up in the 50s. So I don't know where this is. I get in the first verse, she's saying South Howard had disappeared, but this last verse is describing, like, it sounds like something that John Mellencamp would be waxing philosophic about. This isn't, I mean, yes, Ohio has vast stretches of farmland, but not in Akron. But I can't make any sense out of these lyrics in that regard. I get the sentiment, like, hey, you know, malls and stuff suck, but I don't get it. Doesn't make sense. It doesn't represent, other than people standing around on their porch, that very much sounds like Akron life. All right, let's move on. Category 3, wanton whiteness. My city was gone. The Pretenders. Mark, what say you?
I hate this category because I always feel like I get it wrong. It's pretty white. Like, if I think about things that were happening musically in the 80s, obviously Devo was happening, Pere Ubu was happening, and I think they just kind of fall right in with that vanilla, that Caucasian flavor of, you know, salt. not too much pepper. So I feel like it's a one. I feel like it's a one.
Rico, what say you? Wanton whiteness.
Yeah, I mean, although, she's a punker chick, man. When she was in London, she tried to get Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious, one of the two, to marry her so that she could be a citizen of Great Britain. She hung around with Lemmy. There was nothing. She was super cracker white in her being, right? She went to Kent State. She was an art student at Kent State. That's really white, dude, especially in the late 60s. But go ahead, Mark.
I say, did you know that one of her friends was one of the Kent State four that got killed?
One of her good friend's boyfriend was one of the ones that got
killed. Crazy.
I did not know that until I was looking. That's crazy, right? I agree totally. However, instead of a one, I'm going to dial it down to a half a point because I love the funky groove of the song, which kind of takes it down a half a point. So for me, it's going to be a 0.5.
And Rico, what year did you say this song came out? Did you say 81, 82?
I think 82, right?
Yeah, so 82 was the single. It was the B-side to Back in the Chain Gang, and then it was released on Learning to Crawl in 84.
84, because the snare. Mark, you're a drummer. Rico, you're a guy who listens to drums. Talk to me about this snare, man. Because this is an 80s snare, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the big, wet sounding, like, how many wet sponges can you put on top of the head? And just like open, like big gate, you know, a lot of reverb. Like it's just bleh.
Like it's dripping with echo and reverb, and it goes on for miles and miles.
Yeah. Like, and this one's like really, really 80s.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Like if there was a snare drum scale, it would be this to Lars Ulrich on Saint Anger.
So we've got the Lars Ulrich-o-meter and this ranks as this gets a one on the Lars Ulrich-o-meter.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. I would, as a drummer, I would never use this snare sound.
You've got yourself a category, Mark. You can rate the snare on each song on the Lars Ulrich-o-meter, right?
Yeah, I think it's one thing for people who, you know, Mark has mentioned this on his own podcast. I don't know that we've mentioned it here, but Mark is a drummer, and we're not taking full advantage of his presence if we're doing an 80s song. And every time Rico and I talk about an 80s song, I feel like we end up talking about the drums. So we're really not taking advantage of Mark being here. The drums, to me, for better or for worse, when there's no greater identifier. Some might say synth or keyboards, but the uniqueness of the approach to the drums in that decade, I don't think any other decade compares. It's just the 80s stands alone in how they decided to make drums, especially the snare, these giant reverb snares, and it's on this song.
Yeah, and during that time period, there was a huge battle between, you know, miking drums and not resurgence, but kind of the appearance of electric drums.
Right.
And those sound qualities. So like, I think a lot of times engineers were trying to get something in the middle, but yeah, it was a weird time for drum sounds.
Weren't a lot of drums like even if a band had a drummer, didn't they just use a drum machine oftentimes in the studio, or at least like a part of it, like just the snare, for instance, would just be like a sampled snare because they wanted to get that sound and couldn't get it actually.
So I know currently, I'm gonna say in the early 2000s, like I was in the studio and the engineer was like, "What do you want your snare to look like or sound like sonically?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'd love it to sound like the snare on Pearl Jam's 10. So he literally sampled that snare sound and basically did like a digital replacement of every snare hit to make it sound like that.
Yeah.
Back when this was recorded, I don't think, because everything was on analog tape, and splicing in snare hits like that would be a nightmare.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I don't know where I heard that before. Was there a name? Was there a drum machine called like a Korg? Is that what it was called? What am I thinking of?
Simmons.
Yeah.
Well, I know Simmons is what Alex Van Halen started playing around 5150.
Yeah. Yeah, and Roland, the 808 is like the big hip hop drum machine. But yes,
Aren't Korgs synthesizers?
Korgs like are keyboards? Synthesizers.
Okay. Yeah, those are keyboards, right? Yeah. That's okay. What I thought. I wasn't sure on that, though.
All right, I got my peanut butter and my chocolate. All right, let's move on. Okay, I'm giving it a one for wanton whiteness. Let's move on. Malignant machismo. My city was gone. Mark, what say you?
You know, it's interesting, you know, because if you're thinking about machoism, obviously when you think about a female singer, you're not going to score it, right? Because it's, you know, can the female lead vocalist be macho? And honestly, I think lyrically, she actually does have a little, you know, set of testicles that she's kind of swinging around to say, you know what, my city's gone and I'm kind of pissed off and way to go, Ohio. I'm kind of like irritated by this. So I think I'm actually going to give her an honorary 0.5 for machismo.
Rico, what say you?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because this for her in this category is kind of dichotomous, if you will. No matter what song she's singing, she always, her vocals always has this easiness to it. And which I always really appreciated about her. Even like a song like Middle of the Road, where it's, you know, it's a little higher pace, it's a little edgier song, there's still an easiness about her vocals. But having said that, going back to Mark's score on Boomerism, she really is kind of being Uncle Stan here. So rather than just, I have to meet in the middle because her easiness detracts from her Uncle Stanedness. So I'm going to go a half a point on this one as well.
I think what we've wandered into here with this track is I think Chrissy Hynde and Akronite finds herself kind of becoming a Heartland rocker. You know, this is one thing that we have to grapple with here as Midwesterners. Whether we want to claim it or not, we have to own Midwest Heartland rock. I'm looking at you, John Mellencamp, Bruce Springsteen, Bob Seger. Guys, this is where this stuff comes from. And I think you could take these lyrics and if you put an acoustic guitar behind them instead of the big wet snare, no matter its origination, and handed it to John Mellencamp, I think you've got a Heartland rock song. It's right there. Guys, we have to own this. And I think she can't help herself here. She is, even though the Pretenders are not what I would consider a Heartland rock, Midwest rock band. And I don't know, are we embarrassed to kind of be, to have this associated with us musically? I don't know. You guys maybe can talk to me about that. But I think this song kind of wanders into that. And I'm going to say that because of that, I'm going to go ahead and give it a 0.5 for Malignant Machismo because of its white Midwest Heartland rock aesthetic.
Good on you. Man, that's a good question. Are we embarrassed about having to own Heartland American rock? Doesn't Heartland American rock feel really boomerish? I think probably it's the most boomer style of rock, at least like Neil Young, right? Like Crosby, Stills, and like that kind of shit. Tom Petty, right?
Yes.
I personally am embarrassed to claim Heartland rock, but that doesn't mean it's not valid. You're absolutely right. This is Ohio, dude. It's right in middle Heartland of America. So I guess from a certain perspective, like we kind of have to, don't we?
Mark, are you embarrassed?
Slightly, but I always consider Northeast Ohio to be different from the rest of Ohio. Like it's almost its own state. Like we're the 51st state and we're a Great Lakes state. Like
it's funny you say that because like I thought about that this whole week. I'm like, everybody from around here refers to this area as Northeast Ohio and then there's the rest of Ohio. So it's funny you say that because I was thinking the same thing. We really should be a 51st state. That's a great take actually.
So if you were going to make a Mount Rushmore of Heartland rock rockers, you would put Bob Seger from Michigan, right? Yes, because they're just north of us. And then you've got to have John Mellencamp. And is he's Indiana? Is it Indiana, right?
Yeah. Yep. He's Bloomington.
Right. So he's just west of us. And then you have, you've got to put Bruce Springsteen on there east of us.
But he's Jersey.
It's Jersey, but you got to put him in there. And Mark, I'll make an argument for it. WMMS was instrumental in breaking Bruce Springsteen. So even if he wasn't technically a Midwesterner, we're responsible for his popularity.
He wrote Youngstown. So there's that.
Yeah. So who's on my, so Bob Seger, Bruce Springsteen, John Mellencamp, and I think you could even go all the way down to Florida and go ahead and slap Tom Petty's mug up there and just say, that's your Mount Rushmore, man. And I think Chrissy Hynde just finds herself kind of like in that. Now, listen, had our boy Michael Stanley, who spoiler alert is coming up in a future episode. This guy didn't break big, but he's got all the trappings of a heartland rocker.
No doubt. And we'll talk about that at that time, but you are absolutely right. He is probably as big in this area as anything.
All right. So we'll get into that. I got to be contrarian and I'll stop this digression because we're talking about the Pretenders. You two are embarrassed. I am proudly going to take, I'll take John Mellencamp. I love me some John Mellencamp. And I will say, John, come on over to Scott's place. You're welcome to have a beer. We can be grumpy and old together. I will.
Yeah.
Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah. Just make sure you don't talk and use your theater etiquette when John Mellencamp's around, or else he'll yell at you.
He'll yell at me. I fully expect to be yelled at by John Mellencamp, ladies and gentlemen, by the way.
And if it's not John Mellencamp, it'll be me standing behind you.
Only if I've got my phone out.
That's right.
All right, let's move on. Category 5, our final category in our rock and roll autopsy of the Pretenders, My City Was Gone. Culture vulturism. This might be a tricky one. I'm curious what your thoughts are, Mark.
So in 1974, Al Green put out Take Me to the River. And in 78, the Talking Heads did a cover of that song. The bass line for Take Me to the River is suspiciously similar to the warm-up that the Pretenders bassist used for My City Was Gone. So based on where the bass line came from, or at least the inspiration came from Al Green, I'm going to give this a 0.5 for just a little bit of vulturism for where that funky bass line came from.
Interesting. Rico, what say you?
Interesting. I want to expound on that. I don't purport to know more about that, the inspiration for that bass line, than you do. But I feel like it could have been just inspiration only. And can we say that, and maybe Mark, you can help me out with this. Can we say that bass line was lifted, or was it just inspired by? Do you have an opinion on that?
So Tony Butler was the bassist for the Pretenders. Okay. The bass line was something that he would warm up with, similar to the story about Slash and Sweet Child of Mine. So the whole bass line in that song kind of came from that warm up. Where he came up with that warm up is unknown. But the fact that 4 years prior, Talking Heads had a fairly decent hit with Take Me to the River, I think it's fair to say, just because of the similarities, it's definitely an influence, which is why I only gave it a 0.5 and not a full one.
Got it. I'm going to give it a 0, simply because I have to... In science, I feel like there's a delineation between being directly inspired by something and going full on Led Zeppelin here. And I don't feel like he's gone full Led Zeppelin. This song is super unique. You could pick, this is one of those songs that you could pick up pick out of a lineup of 100 songs, and you would immediately, this one would immediately stand out for me anyways. And I feel like any score that I would give it would get reversed by the fact that Rush Limbaugh vultured this song for his own purposes. So that kind of negates any score that I might want to give it anyway. So for me, it's going to be a zero, I think. Go ahead.
So I'm not super deep in the Pretenders catalog. Again, I'm probably one of the MTV fans where I've heard all the singles. Is there another song that the Pretenders have done that have that funky of a bass line?
I only know the hits too, and I can't think of one.
I can't think of, like, everything else is pretty, you know, more straight ahead, more.
This one seems like an outlier. Yeah.
It's an outlier. So, you know, but you know, we all look at the science differently.
It's true.
Which you're thinking makes it a little sussy that it's an outlier in the catalog.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to probably, I mean, it's funny because given her, kind of giving her like bubblegum card stats and who she's running with back in the day, you would expect her to maybe come out with a sound that was a little more punk rock than what the Pretenders really are, which is kind of just like really, you know, it's maybe living in that Talking Heads kind of world a little bit more. I don't know what you would describe this stuff as. I just think of it as FM rock, but yeah, I don't know, man. I'm going to go ahead and give it. They call it new wave, I guess, is how they call it, but I don't really consider them new wave either. But I don't think of this as like a skinny tie band, but maybe I'm wrong. So I guess I'm going to go ahead and give it a zero as well, because I'm going to join Rico on that one and give it a zero. I don't know, man. It might be an outlier in their sound, but ultimately I think their sound is kind of surprising given her stock, where she comes from in terms of who she runs with. But she's looking more and more to me like a Heartland rocker the more I think about it. But I digress. Let's move on. We've got to tally this thing up. Oh, Mark, what have you got there, buddy?
I have got a solid 3.
3. And I have a 2.5. Rico?
Let's see. 87 divided by 4. Carry the 1 times 2. I've got 1.0.
For a grand total of
6.5.
Wow. Big nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Nowhere near the threshold of 12 that we need for it to kill rock.
Oh, good for you.
I gotta tell you, man, I've got, you know, we got a minute or two left here, and I'm shifty in my seat tonight. I've had this issue, and I don't know if it's just aging or what, but I've kind of started using the standing desk at work, you know, because I'm just sitting too much. It's tough on my back. And every once in a while I get tired of standing. So then I'll sit down and I'll just put the laptop in my lap, you know, live up to its name. But I can't get comfortable. And the reason why, and I can't get comfortable right now as I sit here and do this podcast. And the reason is not because of my back. It's because of my balls. It's like having chip chop ham on my thighs, and I'm constantly shifting around. And then the one like slides under and gets pinched uncomfortably. Rico, you're shaking your head. You don't have this problem ever?
No, I'm shaking my head because I absolutely can relate to you on this, and it happens quite often, actually.
Like I've got nowhere to put my sack. It's like, so I can't get comfortable when I'm sitting down, and I don't recall it when I was younger being so flabby.
What kind of underwear are you wearing? Are you wearing straight-ass boxers or your boxer briefs? Or
boxer briefs right now, yes.
Okay, so what you have to do, let me tell
you.
How
did I know you'd have an opinion on this?
Yeah, I know where you are with this. What you have to do is you have to, and you'll find your own way to do this. You have to, when you're sitting down or before you sit down, you've got to gently lift your sack up so it's kind of resting on your legs and not in between your legs, if that makes sense. So it's not going to get stuck in there and make things uncomfortable. So you got to kind of lift her up a little bit.
I try to shake it loose from my thigh, but really what I need to do is stick my hand in there and just move it. But then I've got like nut sweat on my hands and I need to go wash. And so
you can do it from outside of your pants. You don't have to stick your hand in there.
I think I got to stick my hand in there, dude. It's like, I need a spatula.
To each his own, I suppose.
All right. Fair enough. All right. Apologies to Chrissy Hind and Mark from Songs That Don't Suck. The terrible digression.
Really? Oh my God.
All right. Well, I've just been uncomfortable for the last 90 minutes while we're doing this podcast. So it's like, I'm just shifty because of all this nonsense going on. All right, gang. It's been Rock and Roll Autopsy. We'll come back in a month with another Cleveland episode. I know you're waiting with bated breath.
That is correct. I can't wait.
Yeah. And so far, Cleveland looks great.
Yeah, I think this episode gives Cleveland another zero because this song did not kill rock. So therefore, episode two gets a zero. So after two episodes, we have a grand total of 0 points so far. Yep. So we'll see how that goes.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good night now.
Let me have that special rock and roll music. Yeah!
Let me tell you, so the lyrics to real rock music is nothing more than satanic cyanide. Get it out of your house, throw it out, and burn it. It has no place in the house of the righteous.
You guys, it was like a mystique. There's no mystique anymore.
I'm gone.
Follow us on Twitter at RNR Autopsy, or you can send an email to rockandrollautopsy@gmail.com. And if we run across anything good, we'll mention it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Later.
Well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Before you go, if you like heavy metal and stories, then you'll love Battle of the Bands, the narrative form metal podcast that unpacks the biggest rivalries in rock and metal history. Season 1 took in Megadeth versus Metallica, and Season 2 went across the divide to explore the beef between Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. It's like Business Wars, but metal. Find Battle of the Bands wherever you listen to your podcasts, or visit battleofthebandspod.com.